Chapter 38.
"You must eat something," Galloglass insisted, pressing a sandwich into my hand.
"I have to go back in there. The second vote will take place soon."
I pushed the sandwich away. Baldwin had, among his many other instructions, reminded me about the congregation's elaborate voting procedures. 3 votes on any motion, with discussion in between. It was normal for the votes to swing wildly from one position to the other as congregation members considered, or pretended to consider, opposing views. I lost the first vote. 8 opposed and 1, me, in favor. Some voted against me on procedural grounds, since Matthew and I had violated the covenant, and the congregation had already voted to uphold that ancient pact. Others voted it down because the scourge of blood rage threatened the health and safety of all warmbloods, demon, human, and witch. Newspaper reports of the vampire murders were produced and read aloud. Tatiana objected to rescuing the witches of Helm, who, she tearfully claimed, had cast a spell on her vacationing grandmother that made her break out in boils. No amount of explaining could convince Tatiana that she was actually thinking of Cheboksary, even though Rima procured aerial photographs to prove that Helm was not a beachfront spot on the Volga.
"Is there word from Baldwin or Varin?" I asked.
Isola de la Stella suffered from poor cell phone reception, and within the walls of Celestina, the only way to catch a signal was by standing in the exposed center of the cloister in a steady downpour.
"None."
Galloglass put a mug of tea in my hand and closed my fingers around it.
"Drink!"
Worry for Matthew and impatience with the congregation's Byzantine rules and regulations made my stomach flip. I handed the mug back to Galloglass, untouched.
"Don't take the congregation's decision to heart, Auntie. My father always said that the first vote was all about posturing, and that more often than not, the second vote reversed the first."
I picked up the Bodleian tote bag, nodded, and returned to the council chamber. The hostile looks I received from Gerber and Domenico once inside made me wonder if Hugh had been an optimist when it came to congregation politics.
"Blood rage,"
Gerber hissed, grabbing at my arm.
"How did the de Clermonts keep this from us?"
"I don't know, Gerber," I replied, shaking off his grip. "Isabeau lived under your roof for weeks and you never discovered it."
"It's 10:30. Sidonia von Borca strode into the room. "We adjourn at midnight. Let's conclude this sordid business and move on to more important matters, like our investigation of the bishop family's covenant violations."
There was nothing more pressing than ridding the world of Benjamin, but I bit my tongue and took my chair, resting the tote bag on the table in front of me. Domenico reached for it, still curious about its contents.
"Don't."
I looked at him. Apparently my eyes spoke volumes, for he withdrew his hand quickly.
"So, Sidonia, am I to understand you're calling the question?" I asked her abruptly. In spite of her calls for a quick resolution, she was proving to be a major impediment to the deliberations, drawing out every exchange with irrelevant detail until I was ready to scream.
"Not at all," she huffed. "I merely wish us to consider the matter with proper efficiency."
"I remain opposed to intervening in what is clearly a family problem," Gerber said. "Madame de Clermont's proposal seeks to open this unfortunate matter to greater scrutiny. Already the Knights of Lazarus are on the scene and looking for her husband. It is best to let matters take their course."
"And the blood rage?"
It was the first time Satu had said anything, with the exception of her no, when called upon in the first vote.
"Blood rage is a matter for the vampires to handle. We will discipline the de Clermont family for their serious lapse in judgment, and take appropriate measures to locate and exterminate all who might be infected."
Gerber tented his fingers and looked around the table.
"You can all rest easy on that score."
"I agree with Gerber.
Furthermore, no scion can be established under a diseased sire,
Domenico said.
It's unthinkable. Matthew Clermont must be put to death, and all his children with him.
The vampire's eyes gleamed. Osamu raised his hand and waited to be recognized.
Yes, Mr. Watanabe?
I nodded in his direction.
What's a weaver?
He asked.
And what do they have in common with vampires who have blood rage?
What makes you think they have anything in common? Sidonia snapped.
It's only logical that blood rage vampires and weaving witches have something in common. How could Diana and Matthew have had children otherwise?
Agatha looked at me expectantly. Before I could answer, Gerbert stood and loomed over me.
Is that what Matthew discovered in the Book of Life? He demanded. Did you unearth a spell that joins the two species?
Sit down, Gerbert.
Janet had been knitting steadily for hours, looking up every now and again to make a judicious comment or smile benignly.
The witch must answer, Gerbert exclaimed. What spell is at work here, and how did you perform it?
The answer is in the Book of Life.
I dragged the tote bag toward me and drew out the volume that had been hidden for so long in the Bodleian Library.
There were gasps of astonishment around the table.
This is a trick, Sidonia pronounced.
She rose and made her way around the table.
If that is the witch's lost book of spells, I demand to examine it.
It's the vampire's lost history,
Domenico growled as she went past his chair.
Here.
I handed the Book of Life to Sidonia. The witch tried to spring the clasps, pushing and tugging at the metal fittings, but the book refused to cooperate with her. I held out my hands, and the book flew across the space between us, eager to be back where it belonged. Sidonia and Gerbert exchanged a long look.
You open it, Diana,
Agatha said, her eyes round. I thought back to what she'd said in Oxford all those months ago, that Ashmole 782 belonged to the demons as well as the witches and vampires. Somehow, she had already divined a sense of the contents. I placed the Book of Life on the table while the congregation gathered around me. The clasps opened immediately at my touch. Whispers and sighs filled the air, followed by the eldritch traces left by the spirits of the creatures who were bound to the pages.
Magic isn't permitted on Isola della Stella,
Domenico protested, an edge of panic in his voice.
Tell her, Gerbert.
If I were working magic, Domenico, you'd know it, I retorted. Domenico paled as the wraiths grew more coherent, taking on elongated human form with hollow, dark eyes. I flipped the book open. Everybody bent forward for a closer look.
There's nothing there, Gerbert said,
his face twisted with fury.
The book is blank. What have you done to our Book of Origins?
This book smells odd,
Domenico said, giving the air a suspicious sniff.
Like dead animals.
No, it smells of dead creatures. I ruffled the pages so that the scent rose in the air. Demons, vampires, witches, they're all in there.
You mean...
Tatiana looked horrified. That's right, I nodded. That's parchment made from creature skin. The leaves are sewn together with creature hair, too.
But where is the text?
Gerbert asked, his voice rising.
The Book of Life is supposed to hold the key to many mysteries. It is a sacred text. The vampire's history.
Here is your sacred text.
I pushed up my sleeves. Letters and symbols swirled and ran just under my skin, coming to the surface like bubbles on a pond, only to dissolve. I had no idea what my eyes were doing, but I suspected they were full of characters, too. Satu backed away from me.
You bewitched it, Gerbert snarled.
The Book of Life was bewitched long ago, I said. All I did was open it.
And it chose you.
Osamu reached out a finger to touch the letters on my arm. A few of them gathered around the point where his skin met mine before they danced away again.
Why did the book choose Diana Bishop?
Domenico snarled.
Because I'm a weaver, a maker of spells, and there are precious few of us left.
I sought out Satu once more. Her lips were pressed together, and her eyes begged me to remain silent.
We had too much creative power, and our fellow witches killed us.
The same power that makes it possible for you to create new spells gives you the ability to create new life,
Agatha said, her excitement evident.
It's a special blessing the goddess bestows on female weavers, I replied. Not all weavers are women, of course. My father was a weaver, too.
It's impossible, Domenico snarled. This is more of the witches' treachery. I've never heard of a weaver, and the ancient scourge of blood rage has mutated into an even more dangerous form. As for children born to witches and vampires, we cannot allow such an evil to take root. They would be monsters, beyond reason or control.
I must take issue with you on that point, Domenico, Janet said.
On what grounds? He said with a touch of impatience.
On the grounds that I am such a creature, and am neither evil nor monstrous.
For the first time since my arrival, the attention of the room was directed elsewhere.
My grandmother was the child of a weaver and a vampire.
Janet's grey eyes latched onto mine.
Everyone in the Highlands called him Nicky Ben.
Benjamin, I breathed.
Aye,
Janet nodded.
Young witches were told to be careful on moonless nights, lest Nicky Ben catch them. My great-granny, Isabel Gowdy, didn't listen. They had a mad love affair. The legends say he bit her on the shoulder. When Nicky Ben went away, he left something behind without knowing it. A daughter. I am named after her.
I looked down at my arms. In a kind of magical scrabble, letters rose and arranged themselves into a name. Janet Gowdy, daughter of Isabel Gowdy and Benjamin Fox. Janet's grandmother had been one of the Brightborn.
When was your grandmother conceived?
An account of a Brightborn's life might tell me something about my own children's futures.
In 1662, Janet said. Granny Janet died in 1912, bless her, at the age of 250. She kept her beauty right until the end, but then, unlike me, Granny Janet was more vampire than witch. She was proud to have inspired the legends of the Bavin Shee, having lured many a man to her bed only to cause each of them death and ruin after Nicky Ben left her. And it was fearful to behold Granny Janet's temper when she was crossed.
But that would make you...
My eyes were round.
I'll be 170 next year, Janet said.
She murmured a few words, and her white hair was revealed to be a dusky black. Another murmured spell showed her skin was a luminous, pearly white. Janet Gowdy looked no more than 30. My children's lives began to take shape in my imagination.
And your mother? I asked.
My mam lived for a full 200 years. With each passing generation, our lives get shorter.
How do you hide what you are from the humans? Osamu asked.
Same way the vampires do, I suppose. A bit of luck. A bit of help from our fellow witches. A bit of human willingness to turn away from the truth, Janet replied.
This is utter nonsense, Sidonia said hotly. You are a famous witch, Janet. Your spellcasting ability is renowned, and you come from a distinguished line of witches. Why you would want to sully your family's reputation with this story is beyond me.
And there it is, I said, my voice soft.
There what is?
Sidonia sounded like a testy schoolmarm. The disgust, the fear,
The dislike of anybody who doesn't conform to your simple-minded expectations of the world and how it should work?
Listen to me, Diana Bishop.
But I was through listening to Sidonia, or anybody else who used the Covenant as a shield to hide their own inner darkness. No. You listen to me, I said. My parents were witches. I'm the blood-sworn daughter of a vampire. My husband and the father of my children is a vampire. Janet, too, is descended from a witch and a vampire. When will you stop pretending that there's some pure-blooded witch ideal in the world?
Sidonia stiffened. There is such an ideal. It's how our power has been maintained.
No, it's how our power has died, I retorted. If we keep abiding by the Covenant, in a few generations we won't have any power left. The whole purpose of that agreement was to keep the species from mixing and reproducing.
More nonsense, Sidonia cried. The Covenant's purpose is first and foremost to keep us safe.
Wrong. The Covenant was drawn up to prevent the birth of children like Janet. Powerful, long-lived, neither witch nor vampire nor demon, but something in between, I said. It's what all creatures have feared. It's what Benjamin wants to control. We cannot let him.
In between?
Janet arched her brows. They were, now that I was seeing her clearly, as black as night.
Is that the answer, then?
Answer to what?
Domenico demanded. But I was not ready to share that secret from the Book of Life. Not until Miriam and Chris had found the scientific evidence to back up what the manuscript had revealed to me. Once again, I was saved from answering by the ringing of Celestina's bells.
It is nearly midnight. We must adjourn, for now,
Agatha Wilson said, her eyes shining.
I call the question. Will the congregation support the de Clermonts in their efforts to rid the world of Benjamin Fox?
Everyone returned to their seats, and we went around the table one by one, casting our votes. This time the vote was more encouraging. 4 in favor, and 5 opposed. I had made progress in the second vote, earning the support of Agatha, Osamu, and Janet, but not enough to guarantee the outcome when the third and final vote was taken tomorrow. Especially not when my old enemies, Gerbert, Domenico, and Satu, were among the holdouts. The meeting will resume tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock. Aware of every minute that Matthew was spending in Benjamin's custody, I had argued once more for an earlier meeting time. And once more, my request had been denied. Wearily, I gathered up my leather folio, which I'd never opened, and the Book of Life. The past 7 hours had been grueling. I couldn't stop thinking about Matthew and what he was enduring while the congregation hemmed and hawed. And I was worried about the children, too, who were without both of their parents. I waited for the room to empty. Janet Gowdy and Gerbert were the last to leave.
Gerbert,
I called. He stopped on his way out the door, his back to me. I haven't forgotten what happened in May, I said, the power burning brightly in my hands. One day you will answer to me for Emily Mathers' death. Gerbert's head swung around.
Peter said you and Matthew were hiding something. I should have listened to him.
Didn't Benjamin already tip you off about what the witches discovered? I asked. But Gerbert hadn't lived so long to be caught so easily. His lip curled.
Until next evening, he said, giving Janet and me a small, formal bow.
We should call him Nicky Bertie,
Janet commented. He and Benjamin would make a right pair of devils.
They would indeed, I replied uneasily. Are you free tomorrow for lunch?
Janet Gowdy asked as we walked out of the meeting chamber and into the cloister, her musical Scots voice reminding me of Galloglass.
Me?
Even after all that had happened tonight, I was surprised she would be seen with the de Clermont.
Neither of us fits into one of the congregation's tiny boxes, Diana, Janet said,
her smooth skin dimpling with amusement. Gallo Glass and Fernando were waiting for me under the cloister's arcade. Gallo Glass frowned to see me in a witch's company.
"All right, Auntie," he asked, worried. "We should go. It's getting late."
"I just want to have a quick word with Janet before we leave." I searched Janet's face, looking for a sign that she might be trying to win my friendship for some nefarious purpose, but all I saw was concern.
"Why are you helping me?" I asked bluntly.
"I promised Philippe I would," Janet said. She dropped her knitting bag at her feet and drew up the sleeve of her shirt.
"You are not the only one whose skin tells a tale, Diana Bishop."
Tattooed on her arm was a number. Gallo Glass swore. I gasped. "Were you at Auschwitz with Philippe?" My heart was in my mouth.
"No. I was at Ravensbrück," she said. "I was working in France for the SOE, the Special Operations Executive, when I was captured. Philippe was trying to liberate the camp. He managed to get a few of us out before the Nazis caught him."
"Do you know where Philippe was held after Auschwitz?" I asked, my tone urgent.
"No, though we did look for him. Was it Nicky Benn who had him?"
Janet's eyes were dark with sympathy. "Yes," I replied. "We think he was somewhere near Helm."
"Benjamin had witches working for him then, too. I remember wondering at the time why everything within 50 miles of Helm was lost in a dense fog. We couldn't find our way through it, no matter how we tried."
Janet's eyes filled.
"I am sorry we failed, Philippe. We will do better this time. 'Tis a matter of Bishop Clermont family honor. And I am Matthew de Clermont's kin, after all."
"Tatiana will be the easiest to sway," I said.
"Not Tatiana,"
Janet said with a shake of her head.
"She's infatuated with Domenico. Her sweater does more than enhance her figure. It also hides Domenico's bites. We must persuade Satu instead."
"Satu Yarvinen will never help me," I said, thinking of the time we'd spent together at La Pierre.
"Oh, I think she will," Janet said. "Once we explain that we'll offer her up to Benjamin in exchange for Matthew if she doesn't. Satu is a weaver like you, after all. Perhaps Finnish weavers are more fertile than those from Helm."
Satu was staying at a small establishment on a quiet campo on the opposite side of the Grand Canal from Ca Chiaromonte. It looked perfectly ordinary from the outside, with brightly painted flower boxes and stickers on the windows indicating its rating relative to other area establishments, 4 stars, and the credit cards it accepted, all of them. Inside, however, the veneer of normalcy proved thin. The proprietress, Laura Malipiero, sat behind a desk in the front lobby, swathed in purple and black velvet, shuffling a tarot deck. Her hair was wild and curly, with streaks of white through the black. A garland of black paper bats was draped over the mailboxes, and the scent of sage and dragon's blood incense hung in the air. "We're full," she said, not looking up from her cards. A cigarette was clasped in the corner of her mouth. It was purple and black, just like her outfit. At first, I didn't think it was lit. Signorina Malipiero was sitting under a sign that read, "Vietato fumare," after all. But then the witch took a deep drag on it. There was indeed no smoke, though the tip glowed.
"They say she's the richest witch in Venice. She made her fortune selling enchanted cigarettes."
Janet eyed her with disapproval. She had donned her disguising spell again, and to the casual observer looked to be a frail nonagenarian rather than a slender 30-something.
"I'm sorry, sisters, but the Regatta delle Befane is this week, and there isn't a room to be had in this part of Venice."
Signorina Malipiero's attention remained on her cards. I'd seen notices all over town,
announcing the annual Epiphany gondola race to see who could get from San Tomas to the Rialto the fastest. There were two races, of course. The official regatta in the morning, and the far more exciting and dangerous one at midnight that involved not just brute strength, but magic, too.
"We aren't interested in a room, Signora Malapiero. I'm Janet Gowdy, and this is Diana Bishop. We're here to see Satyajärvinen on congregation business. If she's not practicing for the gondola race, that is."
The Venetian witch looked up in shock, her dark eyes huge and her cigarette dangling.
"Room 17, is it? No need to trouble yourself. We can shore ourselves up."
Janet beamed at the stunned witch and bundled me off in the direction of the stairs.
"You, Janet Gowdy, are a bulldozer," I said breathlessly as she hustled me down the corridor. "Not to mention a mind reader." It was such a useful magical talent.
"What a lovely thing to see, Diana."
Janet knocked on the door.
"Camariera?"
There was no answer. And after yesterday's marathon congregation meeting, I was tired of waiting. I wrapped my fingers around the doorknob and murmured an opening spell. The door swung open. Satyajärvinen was waiting for us inside, both hands up, ready to work magic. I snared the threads that surrounded her and pulled them tight, binding her arms to her sides. Satu gasped.
"What do you know about weavers?" I demanded.
"Not as much as you do,"
Satu replied.
"Is this why you treated me so badly at La Pierre?" I asked.
Satu's expression was steely. Her actions then had been taken in the interest of self-preservation. She felt no remorse.
"I won't let you expose me. They'll kill us all if they find out what weavers can do," Satu said.
"They'll kill me anyway for loving Matthew. What do I have to lose?"
"Your children?"
Satu spit.
That, it turned out, was going too far.
"You're unfit to possess a witch's gifts. I bind thee, Satyajärvinen, delivering you into the hands of the goddess without power or craft."
With the index finger of my left hand, I pulled the threads one more inch and knotted them tight. My finger flared darkly purple. It was, I had discovered, the color of justice. Satu's power left her in a whoosh, sucking the air out of the room.
"You can't spellbind me," she cried. "It's forbidden."
"Report me to the congregation," I said. "But before you do, know this. Nobody will be able to break the knot that binds you except me. And what use will you be to the congregation in this state? If you want to keep your seat, you'll have to keep your silence and hope that Sidonia von Borca doesn't notice."
"You will pay for this, Diana Bishop,"
Satu promised.
"I already have," I said. "Or have you forgotten what you did to me in the name of sisterly solidarity?"
I advanced on her slowly. "Being spellbound is nothing compared to what Benjamin will do to you if he discovers that you were a weaver. You'll have no way to defend yourself and will be entirely at his mercy. I've seen what Benjamin does to the witches he tries to impregnate. Not even you deserve that." Satu's eyes flickered with fear. "Vote for the de Clermont motion this afternoon." I released Satu's arms, but not the binding spell that limited her power.
"For your own sake, if not for Matthew."
Satu tried and failed to use her magic against me. "Your power is gone."
I wasn't lying, sister.
I turned and stalked away. At the doorway, I stopped and turned. "And don't ever threaten my children again. If you do, you'll be begging me to throw you down a hole and forget about you." Gerbert tried to delay the final vote on procedural grounds, arguing that the current constitution of the governing council did not meet the criteria set out in foundational documents dating from the Crusader period. These stipulated the presence of 3 vampires, 3 witches, and 3 demons. Janet stopped me from strangling the creature,
by quickly explaining that since she and I were both part vampire and part witch, the congregation was equally balanced. While she argued percentages, I examined Gerber's so-called foundational documents and discovered words such as unalienable that were decidedly 18th century in their tone. Presented with a list of the linguistic anachronisms in this supposedly crusader document, Gerber scowled at Domenico and said these were obviously later transcriptions of lost originals. No one believed him. Janet and I won the vote, 6-3. Satu voted as we told her to do, her attitude subdued and defeated. Even Tatiana joined our ranks, thanks to Osamu, who had devoted his morning to mapping the precise location of not only Helm, but every Russian city beginning with CH, just to prove that the Polish city's witches had nothing to do with her grandmother's skin affliction. When the two entered the council chamber hand in hand, I figured she might have switched not only sides, but boyfriends. Once the vote was tallied and recorded, we didn't linger to celebrate. Instead, Galloglass, Janet, Fernando, and I took off in the De Clermont launch, headed across the lagoon for the airport. As planned, I sent a 3-letter text to Hamish with the results of the vote, QGA. It stood for Queen's Gambit Accepted, a code to indicate that the congregation had been persuaded to support Matthew's rescue. We did not know if anyone was monitoring our communications, but we decided to be cautious. His response was immediate. Well done. Standing by for your arrival. I checked in with Marcus, who reported that the twins were always hungry and had completely monopolized Phoebe's attention. As for Jack, Marcus said he was as well as could be expected. After my exchange with Marcus, I sent a text to Isabeau, worried about the bishop pair. It was another chess reference. We had dubbed Gerber, one-time bishop of Rome, and his sidekick Domenico, the bishop pair, because they always seemed to be working together. After their latest defeat, they were bound to retaliate. Gerber might already have warned Knox that I had won the vote and we were on our way. Isabeau took longer to reply than Marcus had. The bishop pair cannot checkmate our king unless the queen and her rook allow it. There was a long pause, then another message. And I will die first.